So this is Brothers Wisp number 23. I know that because I just checked, because I forget every time. And today we've got Andrew Thrift. A little bit later we should get, what's that kid's name? Mike Hammett. He's kind of the organizer, the mom, I would say. He gets everybody, their lunches packed and gets everybody in order. He'll pop in a little bit later. We got JJ Boyd dialing in. This is the first time I've talked to him in probably 3 months, and he just mysteriously pops into the call. And then we've got Tom Smith, of course. You can't get rid of him. Like we were saying, he's the herpes of the group. And so, really, it's a real treat having Andrew on here. I mean, we've always got Tom, so we've always got international flares. But Andrew's a Kiwi, so he's from... what are you guys just known for? Lord of the Rings, I think? That's about it?
Yeah, Lord of the Rings, kiwi fruit, sheep, milk. That's about it.
Right. Where's Tasmania in relation to you guys? Is that close?
Sorry?
Is Tasmania anywhere near you guys, or is that the other side of the world?
It's pretty far away.
Is it?
It's off the bottom of Australia, but yeah, we are fairly far away from there, a couple of thousand kilometers.
Ah, fair enough. See, I don't know anything about geography. Excellent. But I guess the main topic to talk about today is the 1072. That was announced a little while back, and Andrew Thrift, being the network god that he is, had early access to one of those models, so he's been running it a lot longer than anybody else, at least that I know of. So hopefully he can talk ad nauseum about it and its features and everything he's requested, and I'm sure the 8,000 bugs he's picked up on and reported already.
Well, I'll start off. That's actually... like, hardware-wise, it's a massive departure from all of the previous products MikroTik have done in the past. They've really gone all out on this. They've had some, they've been producing them for over a year now. The unit I've got's a pre-production one, and the date on it is August last year. So they've been around for a while. I'm guessing they must have had some little issues with manufacturing or software that has meant they haven't been able to get them out before now. But it sounds like they're already shipping to distributors, so most people should see them soon. But as far as the product, yeah, it's a massive departure. I've got a couple of different products here to kind of show people so they can see the differences. So hopefully I don't make you too seasick. This is a 1072. Like, straight off the bat, you can see it's a fair bit different. It's a much larger product than the previous flagship, which was the 1036. Not sure if that's actually in frame there.
Yeah, you got it. You got it.
It's perfect.
Yeah, but we'll start off maybe with the 1036. You can see kind of the heatsink in it. It's pretty small. It's all integrated, and you've got dims on board. The 1072, that heatsink's it's a big mama there. Mm. And it hasn't got integrated dims. It's also got separate PHYs. And hardware-wise, there's a lot more SFPs on it. This is the previous one with only... two SFPs, whereas the new one's got eight on it, if you can see that. The other big difference between the 1072 and the previous models is that there's now hot swap power supplies. So if I tip it up, you'll see up here there's actual hot swap power supplies. It's a fairly neat design from MikroTik, even compared to like server vendors like HP and Supermicro and Dell. There's an actual aluminium insert in here that holds the power supplies, so it's fairly sturdy. You're not going to be able to insert them incorrectly anyway.
Okay. Have you actually tested the hot swap capabilities? It works and everything?
Yeah, I have tested the hot swap capabilities, and it does indeed work.
Does it issue a log message in the router so it knows when it's lost a power supply?
Currently it doesn't. This is one of the bugs I found, and well, not really a bug, but a missing feature.
Yeah.
Inside Winbox, when I first got the 1072 a few months back, you could pretty much do whatever you wanted to it. The temperature could be going up and down, could be pulling power supplies in and out, and there was nothing in Winbox to indicate that, or even in the CLI, whereas now in the CLI you can actually see that the power supply voltage has changed. It doesn't send a trap or anything as yet, but I suspect that may come one of the next few releases. They can obviously tell that power supply has been removed by the voltage change. So they should be able to indicate on that. Yeah. So the power supplies, at first I thought were an off-the-shelf item, but they don't seem to be. They're not like a Delta Electronics or anything. They're actual MikroTik branded unit. They don't look like anything out of a Supermicro or anything like that. The other change that a lot of people have been asking for a long time, including myself, is there's actually now on here a retention clip to hold the power cable in.
Nice.
Yeah, so I don't know, most people are probably familiar with these. But if you get an IEC cord and plug it in, it can actually lock the cord in like that, so it holds the cord in, which is pretty nice. If you've got them in a tight rack and you accidentally rip a power cord out by knocking it, that'll prevent that from happening.
That perplexes me why they would design and implement their own power supplies. Any idea why you think they would have done that?
Well, they may be an OEM unit they've relabeled, but, I mean, it's a fair bit of effort to go to just to relabel someone else's power supply. I mean, yeah. I know Juniper and Extreme and HP don't even bother to do that, so, yeah.
Does the Tilera have very sensitive, like, kind of, like, voltage characteristics that, you know, stability-wise and all that type of stuff?
It doesn't seem to. They've got regulators in there that kind of handle voltage fluctuations. Yeah, they're a universal power supply. You guys are pretty familiar. We're not on 110 or whatever volts you got. The US is on, we're on 240. So it's a universal power supply that works everywhere.
That's cool.
Yeah, the other difference is there's obviously four fans inside the unit now instead of the two in the previous 1036. Yeah, the unit I've got is pre-production, so it's got a few differences to the production units everyone will be getting. Like, for example, the one I've got's got different PHY chips that handle the 10 gigabit Ethernet. They changed that in the production one because there were some compatibility issues with different, I think, I couldn't quite find out for sure whether it was SFPs or connecting to older models of Cisco switches. I kind of heard both theories there. But the main reason I had the unit and was testing it was to test that compatibility with different vendors' equipment. And so we tested it with Juniper X4200s and Extreme X650s and 670s and 460s and some Cisco ASR 1000s and a couple of other pieces of hardware, and we had absolutely no compatibility issues as far as the physical layer was concerned anyway. And so for a pre-production product, it's actually been pretty impressive.
That's good. Were you using Cisco optics or were you using just generics?
Whatever I had lying around.
Yeah, there you go.
So, I've tried generic ones from the likes of like Sixcom, Gigalite, Fiberstore, tried some Cisco Genuine Optics, which were just gigabit ones. I've tried, Juniper Optics. I've tried Cisco direct attach cables and Dell direct attach cables, and it all just worked. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Good. Yeah, it's really, really good. They've done a few other changes hardware-wise. Like, if people are really familiar with the older products, they always like had LEDs mounted to the front of the case to indicate things, whereas the 1072, they're using light pipes for every single SFP. So the indicators are pretty nice on it. And just the product in general is a massive improvement on their previous products.
Does it feel kind of chunky, kind of weighty? Or is it still really light?
No, it's definitely fairly chunky. Like, I don't know what weight it is. It's probably like 3 to 4 kilos at least, whereas the previous ones kind of felt like you're lifting a feather. I mean, compared to an ASR 1000, it's like, I don't know, a fifth of the weight, but they're built out of lead, so yeah.
That's cool.
Compared to previous products, it's definitely fairly hefty.
Yeah, you can. Do they still have the ECC RAM in, like, I knew they had that in the pre-production. Do they still have ECC RAM, which I think is a major upgrade as well?
I actually don't know, Tom. I haven't checked. It doesn't indicate it inside router OS, and because they're not, they're actually soldered on now, you can't really tell. So the RAM is not socketed.
Yeah, no, it's just, I heard from, I heard from Yanis when they were, let's say just showing it on display, that they'd gone without the DIMMs because they were actually putting ECC RAM on them, so I wonder, have they kept that model or not? So that was just...
Hopefully they have, because that will definitely be a big improvement.
I remember some rumors, because everybody's talking, and they were saying that something about would this 1072 be able to supply enough voltage on the SFP Plus ports to run, like, 80-kilometer optics and things like, I guess, longer distance? Have you seen any of that?
I haven't tested that. I've got some 40-kilometer optics here, but I don't have attenuators to really test them. I will have some attenuators next week, though, so I can try that. 80-kilometer optics. I mean, the difference between a 40-kilometer optic and an 80-kilometer optic is actually there's no difference between them.
The receive side's better.
Right? Yeah. That's the receive sensitivity, so in theory, if a 10 or 40 kilometer optic works, an 80 kilometer one should as well. Maybe there's just some misunderstanding or FUD there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But no, it definitely seems to be a good product. Another key difference is it's only got 1 gigahertz tiles, so each tile is 1 gigahertz versus 1.2. From the testing we did, it makes no difference. I think the bottlenecks are elsewhere.
Interesting.
The other key things people will notice is the rack mounts are also fairly different. Like, the product's deeper, significantly deeper. So, like, the depth of that's quite a bit deeper than the previous 1036, and the old RB1100 there is even smaller again. So the rack mount brackets are got a fairly big footprint. Now, I don't have any on here, but, yeah, they're a lot wider than the old little square ones that were on the previous model.
I can't remember. Does this thing have a serial port on it? It does, right?
It does. They've changed to the Cisco pinout on this one.
Aha.
And the other thing I really like to see is it's got a real USB port on it, not those silly micro USBs.
Right, right. You got plenty of real estate. Why not go ahead for the full thing?
That's right. And it's also got a full-size smart card slot. Now, I talked to Microtik to try and figure out what this is for, and all I got was a one-word answer of crypto. So that's what they're intending with this, but could potentially be quite a good feature. They did say that the smart cards are really hard to get, and I can confirm that. I tried to get some, and I could only find one place that would provide full-size smart cards. So Microtik have said they may sell smart cards themselves or bundle them with the unit. I'm not sure if there's any update on that or what they're planning to do.
Interesting. So far, what bugs have you encountered that were interesting? I'm sure you've hit some.
Only some really funny little ones. Like, you'd put SFPs in and the indicators would go off, at, like the activity indicators, when you plugged in a link. So instead of showing it was active, it would turn off and stay off until you rebooted the device. It was effectively all the indicators were backwards from every other Microtik and switching product. And just the usual ones like no voltages displaying in one box and that sort of thing. Really minor bugs. Yeah. Seems to be. Yeah, it seems to be fairly similar to the old 1036 and every other aspect.
So what have you done with it so far? I mean, kind of throughput-wise, what kind of paces have you put it through?
Throughput-wise, I haven't really had the equipment to test it, like to really push it. I've probably done maybe 3 or 4 gigabits across multiple sessions. It does have the same, well, I wouldn't call it issue, but it has the same limitations of the previous CCRs in that in a single TCP session, if it's not being fast path, you can only really hit a gigabit throughput in it. If you manage to fast pass packets, we could only really push like the 3 to 4 gigabits that we were able to generate through fast path. I'm sure if we had more traffic to push, we would have been able to get it through though. Yeah. I know the guys. There's some other guys that have got them. Well, I know of one other person with one, and over at stubarea51.net, and they've been able to push fairly large amounts of traffic through them, no problem.
That's cool. So, if you had to go out and say this router is made for this kind of environment, what would you say? So, I know a lot of the WISPs that we end up working with and doing stuff with. I'm sure they have aspirations to run equipment like this, but with their 100 meg internet connection, I can't see this really being a useful product. So where do you really see this hitting home?
I really see it as a small core router or an aggregation router. If you've got a bunch of 10 gig circuits coming in from various providers and you want to route them or bring them into your network, it's absolutely perfect for that. Pairing with internet exchanges and the likes of that thing as well, it's really good for that. And I think with router OS 6 you're never going to reach the full potential of this device because of the limitations, but with router OS 7 it's going to be a really good core and aggregation router for a lot of ISPs, not just wireless ISPs but smaller ISPs as well.
Gotcha. So, I don't know. This would probably be good for data center core, right?
That's right.
Tying in a lot of metro areas.
It looks like it's been designed for data center core, just with the number of 10 gig optics on it. I mean, where else do you need to route 8 times 10 gig connections apart from in a data center core or aggregation? So.
Right, and like an exchange somewhere, something like that. So with these SFP plus ports, can you also put in SFPs? I can't remember.
Yeah, in the testing, I did test those, so tested various different modules, and they all just worked.
All right, so you can do a gig or 10 gig, all that mixes together pretty well.
Yeah, so I tested them connecting through to a Cisco ASR with 1 gig modules from Cisco, and they just worked, and likewise with 10 gig, they just worked.
So. That's cool. So this could be somebody who wants to future-proof an install, right? So
that's right.
You're only really gig today, but that just means all you are is an optical way from upgrading.
Correct. So if you're maybe running dark fiber, or maybe you've got a layer 2 leased circuit now that's gigabit, you can do it with this. And if you upgrade to dark fiber or some other service that's 10 gigabit, you can just swap out the SFP for SFP plus, and away you go. So definite future proofing there.
Do you test it with RJ45, just RJ45 SFP or modules?
I have not tested an RJ45 module. I do have some though, so I'll give those a test too.
I wasn't surprised that you couldn't really stress that. I mean, 80 gigs of internet, that's more than New Zealand has.
More than that, Mike, but yeah, I can't generate it by myself. Yeah, we've just got most of our equipment's actually in another data center, so what's lying around is really old junk that I can't generate that sort of traffic from, so it's a bit of a challenge. Yeah,
That's cool.
I was mainly testing it for kind of our applications and testing stability and what features it does and doesn't have. Yeah.
What's the street price on these things supposed to be? I don't even remember.
It's $3,000 or somewhere around that mark.
Gotcha. So yeah, for the average WISP, that's going to be a little bit spicy just because they're, you know, shoestring budget.
I think I've seen from one of our vendors about $1,800 on one of those U.S. dollars.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's very not bad. Now, I say the average WISP, I didn't mean JJ. Obviously, JJ could probably use something like that.
I don't know. We're hitting some pretty good traffic levels these days.
Yeah, we're starting to, pretty much every feed we pull, we're doing 10 gigs. Even if we're commit is only a gig and it's burstable to 10, we're still going 10 on just about everything, so.
Yeah, I mean, even for us, like, I think we've got 4 gigabits aggregate, including all of our IX connections. We're not going to push this doing internet. We're using this for different applications. We do, inside our data center, we do managed backup services, and we've got a huge number of dark fiber and wholesale layer 2 services going to customers, and we can easily push 10 gigabits across those. We do backups from our customers, so we leak routes and then pull through at 10 gigabit across that. So those are the sort of applications we're using them for. We're not really, if we were just using it for internet, I don't think we'd ever push it at all.
gotcha.
Any tunneling or encapsulation workloads tested? Stuff that kind of pushes it a bit harder?
I tested a bunch of MPLS and VPLS stuff, and I saw fairly similar throughputs to what I did unencapsulated. I think that might be due to the improvements MikroTik have made with being able to fast path VPLS and some MPLS traffic. So it definitely seems to be pretty quick there. I didn't test anything like PPP or Ethernet over IP, but the guys over at Stub Area 51 have done a bunch of testing on those technologies. So if anyone's interested, they might want to head over there and have a look.
I mean,
yeah, I'm pretty much stuck at 6.28 on all of my infrastructure because they broke traffic flow, and we heavily rely on it for billing.
Yeah.
When they introduced Fast Track.
Interesting. I lost my train of thought there. So, I guess, do you have any closing thoughts on the 1072? Anything anybody should know?
Not really. I think it's a router that's going to really show its potential once router OS 7 is out. And I think until then, if you need the port count, it's going to perform just like a 1036, but with more ports until router OS 7 is out.
That's what I was going to say. So there, other than a higher number of cores with a slightly lower CPU, there's no difference between the 1036 and the 1072, the tile era, correct?
No, that's right.
Okay. So it's just the exact same thing, only more powerful.
Yeah.
All right. So if the 1036 can do it, so can this. There's an additional like offload or anything like that.
There doesn't seem to be. The 1072 is basically just two 36 core tiles on the same package, I believe.
Okay, so just a little super glue and stuck them together.
I'm sure it's a little bit more complicated than that. But one of the other things that is different on this is it does have dual M2 slots, which are like a keyed mini PCI Express slot. And I did talk to MikroTik about what they're for, and the only response I got back was for storage. You can effectively put SSDs into those slots, so I'm not sure if they're planning some sort of intrusion prevention or some sort of WAN acceleration. I don't know what you'd need that much storage for, so there's certainly potential for some interesting applications there.
That is. I've been going down the IDS adventure here lately, and we've been doing Security Onion, which is kind of an ISO that loads up and has Snort and Sorby and all kinds of stuff on there. And man, do those things use a lot of RAM. I mean, they're active on the hard drive, but we're trying to aggregate two internet links, and they're doing about a gig on each one. And it's eating every bit of 96 gigs, so we ordered 288. We're going to see what it does.
Be just due to the ring buffers and all the signatures that are stored in RAM.
Yeah, because we're trying to keep as much live information as we can, which is pretty awesome. You know, if you see an anomaly, you click on it, actually opens up the actual captured packets. You can follow the stream.
Are you doing any automatic triggering of BGP black holes or anything like that?
I don't trust it that far yet. It's just send me an email. That's all I want from it right now. That's cool. But man, I just think about how intensive it is on, you know, like a 12-core server, which is a ton of RAM. I can't imagine what it would do to a 1072 trying to do something like that. I guess it would have to be a much scaled-down version that obviously didn't keep, like, live package and did stuff like that.
Yeah, JJ touched on something there previously in his comment that they couldn't use, from 6.28 onwards, they couldn't use traffic flow for accounting. That's something we've encountered too. It's due to FastPath on the MikroTik bypassing a bunch of the mangle rules. Currently, traffic flow in router OS works through some hidden mangle rules. That's what it appears to do, that count the traffic flows and report them back via NetFlow. With FastPath, obviously, you're bypassing that because it's being FastPath through the unit and you can't see the information. Something I've requested from MikroTik, and the answer I got back didn't sound too positive, but who knows, things change. Hopefully it does happen, because I mean, Cisco supported with Cisco, with CEF and Juniper and Alcatel, and all those guys support it. And I mean, the information's on router OS in the contract table. Surely it's if it's there in router OS, they can export a flow with it. So we'll see what happens.
I'm sure you could get some support from a few people who watch this.
Yeah, I would certainly love to see that, because it's been a challenge to maintain billing continuity with upgrades. So I've played the up-down game a lot.
Gotcha. Well, I mean, a stable network only helps you if you can bill your customers, right? So
that's right. Well, it's not stable for long if you can't bill your customers.
There you go. Yeah, it's not sustainable. There you go.
And FastPath is no use if you can't bill your customers either.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. None of this is worth anything if you can't get paid. I know Mike's in a charity.
About the Security Onion, like, how do you find it, or how are you finding it? Do you recommend it? What's the feature set like compared with the normal Snort?
Well,
type setups.
So I'm doing another another service that I'm not necessarily ready to talk about yet, but it's a forward-looking internet probe system. And so I needed a beefy server for that. And I thought, hey, why don't I get this beefy server in? I could test the feasibility of using kind of an IDS. And though the server was really, really super taxed, it was able to at least give me an idea of whether it was going to work or not. And it's going to work, so I'm ordering some much heavier iron to be able to handle it. But I thought, Security Onion, I like it because it's the easy button, right? You throw it in, it boots up Ubuntu, and there's a link, and you click that says install. And then the guy's got a terrific set of steps to walk through to get it configured. Now, there's a lot of different options in there that I just have to test with. Like, you can collect this much live information, or you can do headers only. And then over here, you can do this much, or the, you know, so it's, I guess it's really going to be us just kind of trying to balance and see how much detail we can get versus when the server just falls over. But so far, it's been really cool, and I actually found pretty quickly a couple of exploited servers, MikroTik DNS servers that were left wide open, and one of them may have been mine somewhere, and then one of them may have been somebody else's. So it really quickly aggregates, like, it's really, you know, and maybe I'll walk you guys through it at some point once we get it stood back up and show you. Just, it's really super easy. Within 10 minutes, you have it up and running and tuned for the most part. You know, you see signatures of, hey, there's a lot of DNS traffic over here. Well, then you can look and see, well, what are the top requested URLs? And then, oh, it looks like this government site's been requested 600,000 times in the last 2 hours. Maybe I should look at that and see who it came from. So it's really, really, it makes, and then so you just go and you pull and say, oh, it all came from this guy. And then you just look up who that customer is, and half the battle is telling people they have a problem. The other half is showing them screenshots of, here's the actual information, showing that, hey, coming from you, there's this huge, you know, so it just makes it really easy. It's irrefutable evidence.
Pretty cool.
Part of something we've been doing at work is we have what we call the no apologies infrastructure, right? So the idea is we never do anything we have to apologize for. And part of this is been going through this threat matrix, like what happens if zombies attack? Like, that was kind of literally one of our things, right? You know, so like the city gets shut down around us, what do we do? You know, so it's coming up with all these different what ifs, you know. And so part of that is, what happens if we get hit with a DDoS? You know, one is, how do you detect a DDoS? You know, first you have to have something that's actually watching for it, you know. And so that's kind of where this was born out of. And I definitely knew to this space. That's why I like the Security Onion. I know Andrew Thrift smiling over there, because he's, if I'm talking about it, he's done it 10 years ago. So, you know, he's been there, done that. And then Tom is definitely the security guy as well.
Well, we do it 10 minutes.
10 minutes.
I'm definitely behind on that one. I'll be downloading that ISO now, firing it up.
It's really neat and easy to use, and the guy who puts it together maintains it really well. He stays on top of it. He'll probably lose that tenacity and that zeal before too long. As anybody knows, you put stuff out for free on the internet, you kind of, nothing ever comes back to you from it. But he's doing really good work. And it's at least a good jumping off point, at least for somebody like me. It's got an option for start with Snort or start with Suricata. So it's got built in, and then it's start with...
So that's the two engines.
Yeah, I mean, they're right there ready to go, which are the two main ones that I know about anyway. And then it's, well, where do you want to pull your rule set? Just the regular GPL? Here's these different subscription ones you can pull from. You know, he makes it really easy for an idiot like me to get it up and running. And then all the notification pieces, all that stuff's in there.
Sounds like the sort of product that's, or project that's really good if you're not that familiar with intrusion prevention. Yeah. Hang it in a server, get it up and running, see if it's what you want, what you like, and then if you do, then maybe you can spend the time working out how to install the software yourself and tune it.
Yeah, and it's definitely showing me what parts of it are more interesting to me, so I can...
Is there any alternatives to a CNS?
To what? What?
Is there any are there other alternatives? Just Thrift was saying there's... Or he was alluding to maybe other products.
No, I've really only used Suricata straight on servers and many moons ago Snort. But when I used Snort, I really had no idea what I was doing with it. Yeah.
Well, that's where I'm at right now. But this guy takes a lot of the work out of it, and it's showing me, yeah, these things are interesting to me, these aren't, and I'm going to move more towards that. So it's really cool.
Are you using it on a span, or are you using it as a kind of a through device, like, or are you just on a tap?
I'm doing span ports coming. So it's coming off of 7600s, and span ports are all done in hardware, so you don't have to worry about overrunning CPU or anything like that on Cisco's. So it makes it really easy. I also found out that in 7600s, policy-based routing is done in hardware, all kinds of fun stuff. And here recently, this is a fun one for you. If you overrun the CAM table on a SOUP 723 BXL, right, so you pull too many routes in the route table and it switches that over to the hardware table for CAM, if it overruns that, even if you lower, immediately it starts process switching all that stuff, right? So it hits the processor. So even if you lower your route table over here, it's still stuck in process switch. And the only way to make it stop process switching is to reboot it, which I thought was so fun. Because somebody was like when we were initially doing some troubleshooting, they were like, why don't you just reboot it? I was like, you don't just reboot it. That's not going to fix it. And it turns out just rebooting it would fix it. And it felt kind of stupid. I was like, that never works. You can't just reboot it. It's not going to fix it. And then after much research and digging and ultimately figure out what the problem really was, it's like, oh yeah, you just reboot it. Okay.
So, but remember, like yourself and Andy there, like I was talking to a friend of mine who's a CCIE 10,000 and something, and I was saying, like, do you ever reboot stuff? And he goes, rebooting is like giving up. It's like saying, I don't know quite what's wrong yet. So he was saying he just loathes to actually say, I think we need to reboot. So he just says, that's what you do when you give up.
That's right.
Yes. So, if you I'd be kind of going, spend 10 minutes something. Looking at it and kind of go, look, we can either keep looking or we could just try to reboot. We're back up quicker, so.
If you reboot something, you never know what the problem actually was.
Exactly.
Yeah. I agree.
But it fixes it, especially if it's a tight spot.
it's kind of rock and a hard place. You're like, don't know, don't think I'm going to find the answer in 10 minutes. Reboot it, it'll be back in 5, hopefully. Fingers crossed. Do it!
We had one recently where we had a couple of really big switches that are in a, what's called a multi-chassis lag. It's kind of like a stack, but the switches operate independently, and you can create a lag from both of them. And one of the switches started effectively black-holing traffic in the forwarding database. So all the MAC addresses were in the forwarding database, but it was sending the traffic to nowhere. And, of course, it took everything down. And all the customers were yelling, and we could have spent a whole lot of time figuring out what was wrong, but we could reboot the switch and make it work again. So we chose the reboot the switch and make it work again solution.
Wasn't that right after you upgraded some Microtik equipment or something?
It was. We actually thought the problem was the Microtiks at first, and then we soon discovered that that was just the red herring. The problem was actually some completely different bug in another vendor's equipment. Yeah, it was a pretty fun time. Yeah.
I know, if anything, if I ever die suddenly, you'll know that it was due to a red herring like that. Because if anything makes me suicidal, it's you're chasing your tail over here and it's completely, they're not related issues. And it's just, oh God. I got hit probably about 3 weeks ago with 3 independent issues that looked correlated, but they were all separate. And so it took me forever to settle that one out.
Did you reboot anything, Greg?
No, I didn't reboot anything. No, I didn't reboot anything. I don't ever get to reboot anything. Not at the data center. Outside the data center, we can reboot stuff, but not in. Takes all the fun out of it. Boom. All right, so I think we beat the 1072 to death about as much as we can.
Oh, actually, one other thing I was going to mention. A few other people have asked me if this would make a really good BNG or PPP concentrator. And it potentially could, but we'll see how RadarOS 7 goes, because RadarOS 6 is missing quite a lot of features that are used in that space, just to do with radius attributes and so on. and there still seem to be a few issues with people running PPP tunnels, overloading the CCRs currently.
Interesting. So, you know, that brings up another interesting question for me is, Microtik's been going through sort of an internal revolution. I guess if anybody who's been working with them for years knows that there hasn't been at least a lot of transparency and version control and things like that, and then all of a sudden out of nowhere, now there's bug fixes. So you have revision, and then they're doing incremental bug fixes, and the new versions where they actually introduce features, which is just radically different, and then like the software update, I don't know if you guys have noticed in there, but now there's a drop down that you can say, show me new releases or just bug fixes, or, you know, right inside the router. And it makes me wonder, makes me feel like version 7 is going to be pushed out even further, because do you think they're going to try and who knows, right? You just look in your crystal ball, but are they going to try and build up version 7 to be equal features exactly what we have now in 6 and then release it? Or do you think they're going to try and get most of the features there? So 6 will actually have more features than 7, but 7 will be stable and they'll just release that. I mean, what do you think they're going to go with it?
Yeah, definitely a crystal ball there. I have no idea. It seems like this versioning is a response to all the complaints from the users and people on the forums, and I think it's a good thing. I think a lot of the wording around it that they've used is very, very confusing and may cause them more issues than they've had previously. Yeah, calling something a current release, people just assume it's stable, but that's not the case. Yeah, I think that side of it will make it confusing.
Yeah, no, I think they've come a long way, but they have a certain amount to go to improve better, like, you know.
Yet, I was really hoping Tom was going to offer his insights on Router OS 7 and Microtik software. I was really hoping you were going to do that.
No, I think that you know, we've, let me phrase this properly. I think that Router OS 6, what features are advertised should work in it before going to a new operating system.
So for version 7, you're saying that they should have all the same features but stable, rock solid stable, and then release it. Is that where you're going with it?
I'd be saying 6 stable, new features, and 7, please.
Okay. But they're supposedly rewriting
that. You know what I mean? Like, but
portions, right? So it makes me wonder, if you're like the routing engine, you're supposedly completely rewriting it. Can you? Well, I mean, they've been talking about version 7 for a long time, so I was going to say,
I don't think you can properly test it until you put it out there in all the different environments.
Like Windows 10, just give it away for free and let everybody
beta
test
it. Just put it out there and then work through it.
Well, that's what MakerTik have been doing for the last, Microsoft are just copying MakerTik because you have free upgrades since 2.9, so.
My impression is that version 7 is getting
But no, like, I think it's positive.
What were you saying?
They don't have a known issues log yet.
Sorry, my impression is that version 7 is getting further and further away. I mean, there's just no news out of Microtik. Every time you email support with a valid problem you've discovered, you just get back that it's fixed in version 7 or no answer. But version 7's not here, and there's no news on how far away it is or when it will come or anything.
But I don't think that that's an acceptable answer they should be given. Like, you know, saying that it'll be a feature that's meant to be currently supported is going to be fixed in the new version.
You mean like BFD?
Pardon?
You mean like BFD?
Or, well, like, I haven't really used much of that, but, you know, I think we need to be harder on them as a community when they drop the ball like that. Like, is it, they shouldn't say it'll be fixed in the next release, because it's an abandoning the responsibility to release stable software and support it as a stable software. So I'd be
they're
kind
working
of
on the dude right now.
Sticking resources in the dude, I guess. Now, didn't they say the dude's not dead, right?
Yeah.
Why don't they just buy NetXMS?
Right.
So on the BFD, what is the issue with that?
I think that's on our list of things to talk about, so I'll go into a bit more detail. BFD appeared to work in earlier versions of RouterOS, so I at least tested it in 4 and 5, and we had it running in production on 6.5 for years. And then when we upgraded to 6.19, all these forum posts I'd remembered of people having problems with BFD came flooding back to me as we started to have problems with BFD. Basically, we run OSPF to a bunch of peers, and we use BFD to detect, changes to the path so that it brings down the OSPF session a lot faster, and sometimes the BGP session. And in version 6.19 and any releases since then, it may have even happened before then, but I didn't test those releases, OSPF just won't establish to peers. It'll often basically go to a two-way state or a full state and then drop back down again. And if you do a debug log, it basically says that it's not establishing because there's no BFD session with that peer. Yet it's a valid BFD configuration, everything's working, and they might say you had a subnet with 5 routers in it or 6 routers in them. And the other 5 will all be happily talking OSPF and BFD, and just one of them won't. And you reboot it, and it makes no difference. So there seems to be some inherent issue in version RouterOS 6 with BFD and OSPF, and also BFD and BGP. And they've indicated that it will be fixed in version 7, but they've given no indication as to when we might see that.
That's interesting, because I was using BFD and OSPF together, mostly with no issues all the way up to 6.27, and then I saw that you had been having issues with this, and so I was just, that kind of caught me off guard, I guess.
We've been using it in 6.5 with zero issues for a very long time. It's only when we went to 6.19 that they kind of popped up.
Was Andrew, you're running with multiple routing tables, would I be correct in saying that?
Sorry, what's that, Tom?
You're running multiple routing tables, maybe. That
means routing tables, Andrew.
we are running a large number of routing tables. Most of our routers will have, 20 to 100 routing tables in it, but we're not using OSPF within those routing tables. We only use OSPF for our backbone to kind of get between routers.
Alright. Yeah, it still surprises me, because I don't recall any issues from 6.19 to 6.27 ever in OSPF configuration.
I've seen quite a few problems in OSPF with IP aliases hanging off the interfaces. As far as with seemingly on a reboot, or if the router went offline, that it would come back up and try to form the peer with an alias IP, or which one ever MikroTik thought to be numerically higher, seemingly. And it's a problem that, have you guys seen any of that, or am I the only idiot running a bunch of aliases off of the same
interface? It could be too, that we primarily were using OSPF on point-to-point only. So if you have multiple routers on one interface, maybe that's the issue.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's only 2 routers in between, but like there would be a whole bunch of gateways for different layer 2 segments coming back in. And this comes from converting a bridge network to a routed network and trying to slowly weed out the frustration.
Convert it faster.
No, I've seen that. I've seen that. Like, I've been honest, JJ, I've seen that as well when you're migrating from the customers from bridge routing, bridge networks to a routed network or a routed network. And you do, like, when you have multiple IPs on an interface, I've had stability issues on that. But, like, being honest, when I find, like, if you have point-to-point links, if you're on either point-to-point mode, it's the way we do it now. But non-broadcast multiple access over wireless seems to be solid. Slower to convert. It takes about 3 minutes for a link to come up. So if a link flaps, it's a 3-minute hit with non-broadcast multiple access while with the point-to-point way, it seems to be rock solid, to be fair. And even like, as Alex was saying, you know, if you have multiple routers, let's say just on a, or routers on a LAN, a switched LAN, like I haven't had any issues with that, but we haven't had the IP aliases, which are obviously a necessity in your case. It's just, unfortunately, you need to go through the pain of migrating from a bridge network to a routed network very quickly because of that stability issue, you know. But I'm not too sure if any other vendor, to be fair to Microsoft,
what I found them doing was just carving out VLANs and looping through the switches and back into the routers to have the routed capabilities and have the PoE capabilities of the switches. And that seemed to cure it. That way there's only a single address on the interface, and I am running NVMe. But yeah, it was odd. It was something that I didn't expect in the migration.
You know, talking about point to points, have you guys ever tried to use /31 addressing on your point to points with MikroTix?
I haven't used /31 specifically, but I have basically set the network as the next hop address, so
yeah,
similar to a /31, and that works perfectly.
Yeah, I tried /31 routing, and it didn't work for me.
No, like, yeah, but yeah, basically, yeah, the way Andrew Trift was described is the way we do it as well. So we have brought it in /31s, which is technically incorrect according to the standard. It's 2/32s. That works fine.
Yeah, because like on some of my Cisco stuff, I'll do /31s, and it sends a warning. It's like, hey, watch out, you sure you know what you're doing? But it goes ahead and lets you do it. But the MikroTix, you can't put /31s on there and have them communicate with everything.
That's where Cisco is breaking a standard, and MikroTix is...
That's what I keep telling you. If you invent the gear, you can basically tell it it's going to do whatever you want it to do.
It's like ATT 568A versus 568B, yeah?
It doesn't matter, man. If you invent it, or if you have enough money, you know, people will do whatever you want. That's kind of how it works. What is it if
you... So, kind of...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, to kind of do what I do and segue into another thought thread, we'll call. I did Asterix and IPv6 for the first time this past week. I actually pulled it off. And,
oh, that's fun.
Yeah, and it works. Unless you're trying to run, what is it, PJ SIP channel driver, as opposed to CHAN SIP channel driver, or SIP CHAN, or whatever they call it. You can't bind PJSIP currently to an IPv6 address, at least in the distro I was using.
So and, are you doing just straight Asterix, or are you doing kind of like a flavor, like Elastix or something?
Yeah, the one that I'm running is FreePBX, but it's so heavily backhanded.
Right.
Like, at this point, I'm not, like, I can't touch the GUI on certain portions of it anymore because I went in there and massaged so much of the config, GUI will just wipe me away. If,
right.
If
it
I do,
it would undo everything you put in.
So yeah, pretty much.
Do you have a SIP trunk provider that's doing IPv6 support?
No, I'm basically doing like translation. I'm working with him to get his infrastructure over to IPv6. He's a regional SIP provider, and he's going to talk to me on IPv6, but he'll still be talking to, you know, like in this case, Level 3 is one of his big upstream SIP providers for that he brings the IDs and whatnot in. But anyway, I'm talking, all my phones are talking to the device on IPv6. So the reason that I was so interested in getting this working is to get rid of all the NAT traversal issues. So we deployed a new phone system for a customer, and all their phones are talking back to the PBX in our data center on IPv6, and then we're talking on a single IPv4 address to him. And that IPv4 address is NATed because we have very few IPv4 addresses left. So I have to be so careful. So I'm just punching ports and have all of our PBX NATed, and then now I'm just going to put all of the customer phones on IPv6 talking back to us. And it's working really smooth.
That's pretty awesome.
JJ, are you doing dynamic routing with IPv6, or are you just doing kind of auto-configure and kind of static IPv6 routing, or how is that working for you?
All the servers I'm putting on static addresses, and then I'm using auto-config and OSPF to carry it through the core of our network down to the customer edge, and then I'll throw up like an address off of that interface. And then I'm still trying different things on our deployment strategy. Now that as of 5.6, Ubiquiti has IPv6 in their firmware, so we're actually using the Ubiquiti radios for the IPv6 routers. And in all that, I'm having to do static routing because their auto configs isn't working correctly for me. So as long as I enter static addresses in there and then go in and put in a static route, because they omitted that in the user interface, but go in and put in a static route and save it, it works fine for me.
How many phones do you have hanging off your network that you guys support?
I don't know. There's probably all of our business customers and whatnot, there's probably 200 phones.
That's a lot of static routing.
Yeah, but the phones themselves, it's not all that bad because I'm not actually having to. I just route the prefix. Well, I'm not routing the prefix out there. I just hang that prefix off of that segment, and then OSPF carries it out there. Where if it's like 4 or 5 pops away.
Gotcha.
And then but I do have to hang those there, or those prefixes off.
So speaking of Ubiquiti, Mike maintains this cute little list of stuff we can talk about. In there, he put in that Ubiquiti put out a 1.8 for their edge router, and in there they announced support for MPLS and BFD and something else that might have been interesting. I still don't really know a lot of people that are running the edge routers in production yet to be able to look at these features. Thrift, I think you said you were possibly interested in looking at the edge router now that they added MPLS support, right?
Yeah, I'm going to buy one next week and have a bit of a play with it, see what they've done and see how logical it is and see if it actually works.
If home use counts as production, I've had it in production for a couple months now and it works pretty well.
Pretty stable?
Yeah, rock solid.
What's the GUI like, and what's the command line interface like, or how do you find it?
The GUI's not bad, but I don't know, I tend to stick to the CLI, and I really love the commit confirm options that, it's very Juniper-like.
Yeah.
I think Juniper and EdgeRouter both come from Asterix, which is based on, or not Asterix,
Viata is what?
Viata, and I think Viata was based on something else,
Junos, right? I think
is that how it is?
Yeah.
Viata is based on Junos?
Yeah.
So Juniper, Viata, then EdgeRouter.
Yeah.
The chain, yeah. Anyway, but the
Chang
is pretty awesome.
Ubiquiti.
What's that?
Came from Ann Chang over at Ubiquiti, kind of the lead programmer on the project. He came from originally from Juniper, and then he was at Viata. Now he's over there.
I thought some of the guys
use Brocades or V routes Brocade Pub. Sorry.
I was just going to say, I thought one of the guys on the Edge Max team actually came from Cisco as well, right?
He did. That was Stig.
Okay, yeah.
Anyway. Really nice.
It's stable. They've got some great features, and like it was said before, the platform's not just stagnating. They're actually working very aggressively to get new features in and to deal with bug fixes. Ubiquiti, I've been very impressed with how well the EdgeRouter team involves the community and gives credit where it's due. And
absolutely. I was going to say that if everyone would do change logs like Anqing does, logs, the entire world would be better.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they just have, it's like 6 pages of links to forum threads. Bob had this problem right here and fixed it. Jim had this problem, and he fixed that one. And it's just a huge list of stuff that people have found, and they fixed it, and they said he found it.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
I've seen a couple of vendors do that. I mean, I know Fortinet and Extreme do it, certainly. If you look in their release notes, they'll have a link to all of the different either knowledge base articles or forum threads of problems people have had, and indicate that that's what has fixed it. And it sounds like Ubiquiti are doing the right thing there as well. It would be nice if other vendors did that too.
And they also just released that bug bounty system, right? Ubiquiti did.
That's a secure bug one, isn't it?
Do what?
Or is it?
For security related.
Yeah, security yes. Rewards program.
Yeah.
I think they announced it in, like, what was it, a day later, 2 days later? They had a major security update that came out.
Yeah, and I heard rumors that it was, and then some that wasn't, so I'm not sure if it was from that directly or not, but...
Yeah, I was going to say, that's awfully fast if it did come from that, or, yeah, if it came from the announcement of that program, it was awfully fast.
There's a lot of good automated tools like Burp. I don't know if any of you have used it, but for application level scanning of websites, it's absolutely awesome. It's a Java-based program. It's quite cost-effective too. It's a Java. Yeah, I know. I said it very quickly. I'd like to move on from that point, but it actually works quite well from some of the application pen testing that we've done. So, you know, if you put that against, let's say, an edge router working in the house, it would probably, or any router for that matter. Political question, but I may as well ask it. What about the edge router OS? Are they doing, like, releases of source code upstream to VYOS, what's the policies there?
No, they forked it. Viata got bought out by Brocade, and then so they're on the Napa Valley fork of Viata, and they're just running forward with it there.
No, what I mean is, so as far as I know, it's Viata, and then there was a community fork of Viata, which is VYOS, and then there's a fork again, which is EdgeOS. Well, right, say that. So let's say the Brocade one is twice removed.
I would guess that they have done some upstream pushes, but not everything, because a lot of it's proprietary to their hardware.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or you know, their GUI or their
right
thing.
Do HOS support x86 yet, or are they planning any support for that? Or
I would never. I don't think they'll ever do that.
For what did you say?
I believe they'll never do that.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously,
they sell hardware and kind of give the software away. They have what I would call the Apple model over at Ubiquiti.
Yeah, ever since they left the Super Ranges and the Extreme Ranges and the whatever else their single boards were, yeah, it's been all, you know, their hardware with whatever they do.
Alright, so speaking of Ubiquiti stuff, again, they announced, was that like 2 days ago, a big line of new Unify AC stuff.
Yeah.
Several models.
I'm very excited to see that. Has anybody seen the price points on the lot?
I haven't seen the price points on any of this stuff, and I've barely even read the marketing materials. I mean, it's so new that it just came out, you know.
When you compare it to other products, though, like Aerohive or Ruckus or anything else, it's going to be cheaper, so... The price point, as long as it's cheaper, is probably pretty good.
They're shooting for it, and they have what? They have a light, a long range, a pro, and an EDU. The EDU is
it looked like
expansion.
The
EDU's got a speaker in it.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if they're going to allow use of that speaker outside of their mobile app. Like if you can do a Sonos style type thing and pump your music out on them, that'd be kind of cool.
Or have like a SIP port into it, so you could just
right.
Pull it from a phone and yell over the loudspeaker. That would be really cool. Turn it into almost like a PA sort of system.
It does look like some of the pricing is out. Looks like MSRP on the AC Lite, for example, is $89.
Very nice. I told everyone that I worked with, I guaranteed that the Lite would be sub $100.
Yeah, I just spent.
Cool, and I've seen that they're going to do 5 packs on those, which is good for
right at $399.
Yeah.
And so somebody was saying that they knew somebody who had had some early models of that, that maybe they could talk about it.
Yeah, there's some people that have some of that stuff up there.
maybe they can't talk about it yet.
Looks like even the Pro with the 3x3 is only $149. And, did I miss something, or are we already on the Unified Controller version 4?
We're just skipping around to the interesting stuff.
Oh, no.
Does anyone know?
But I'm not sure what happened with the Unify stuff. It just, also we're on 4.6 point something. And I'm like, wait, what happened to all the others? I think it was probably when they started doing all the phones and this and that, they probably had to release, rebuild stuff. And so they just jumped versions.
Now,
has anyone
actually
used the phone?
I have.
I know Disher runs the phones and he says they work fine.
Yeah, I have a couple of them, and I'm going to be frank. They're poo-poo right now. It's like
we fair to phones. We've tried out one phone, and the phones do look awesome.
They look awesome.
The hardware looks good, yeah.
And like Android OS.
But using Android on your desktop where you can't pick the thing up is so awkward. I tried to run it on my desk for a week, and then I had my phone laying on my desk, my mobile phone. And then I had this phone, so every time I get a Gmail notification, I get it on the browser, and I get it on the desk phone, and myself, it was like, I was having to acknowledge notifications three times. I think they need to heavily customize Android instead of just throwing vanilla out there and putting their SIP app on top of it.
Yeah, no,
they had this whole ecosystem thing planned, and then I was looking at the forum when I got a link about something else. I was kind of digging through some of the other announcements, and I saw that they were already shutting down their own VoIP server. They said, we're just going to cancel trying to build our own or change our own and just make the phone better for all the third-party stuff that's already there.
Gotcha.
So that's kind of a big swing that they already made in that whole product line.
But it's a smart move if you think about it, because the investments on the phone, what's it, $150, $200 or something like that? But if you have an ISP with 10,000 subscribers, that's like 2 million in phones. So you just get one product right, get it doing working quite well, and you stamp it out like cheap plastic toys.
Speaking of products, they work well. The 3 gigahertz Air Fiber X's are amazing.
Hey guys, speaking about jumping around a lot.
Turn, bam. Speaking of,
we're playing my game
now. But just to close out that phone thing really quick, like JJ was saying, they give the software away for free, so to put so much time and effort into developing something you're going to give away for free to sell a really cheap phone and make a tiny margin, I don't know that it really tracks. So it seems like they're maybe just refocusing on what's important.
Well, and there's good free software out there already.
A ton of it, yeah.
And it's compatible with it, so why?
Yeah. Why bother? So popping back in, we've got extra personnel now. So Alex Hart jumped in. You're up in Seattle, right?
I was in Seattle. I'm now in Portland.
Ah.
Right. You had seen the last podcast.
I have not watched it. I was working. And then we've got Thomas up here, the famous, the beautiful, world-renowned bikini model Thomas.
I would put my shirt down, but, I don't want to embarrass everybody, so.
Absolutely. And we appreciate that. So JJ wanted to hang a Yui and talk about, what was that?
Air Fiber X.
Yeah, the Air Fiber X. They released the 2.4 gig, the 3 gig, and they've had the 5 gig around for a while. And, pretty much the same performance, but now in 3 gig. And in the U.S., a lot of 3 gig spectrum is probably about to get opened up for use for WISPs and whatnot. But the spectrum, we've got several licenses about that we weren't using for 3 gigs, so we hung some radios and got them up. Noise floors are super quiet, so you get, you know, at this point, perfectly unobstructed transmissions. And not only that, we did some GPS sync to another site, and it actually works. So high five to the AirFiber team over at Ubiquiti. They, you know, we're running 20 megahertz channels right now, and we're seeing, you know, aggregate throughput very close to 200 megabits. We're doing 75 splits on the transmit receive duty cycles, and working really good.
So you said 200 megs, 20 megahertz channels. How noisy is your environment? Pretty quiet?
The R3 gig environment, pristine.
Oh, on your 3 gig, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
How long is
it? Yeah, on 5. This first one we did one side, you know, one side out was 11 miles. The other side out was like 4 miles. And it's just awesome. We're running the same frequency back-to-back at the masters and just enabled GPS sync. And the way that the bandwidth is set up is, you know, the slave on one side is 75% receive, and then the transmit side on the back of that is 75% transmit. So it gets a little goofy when you're doing the GPS sync. So I was really trying to master that. So we finally backed it down to 50-50 on the duty cycle, and I got something that worked well until I can get in there and play a little more.
What's the street price on these guys?
Those radios, I think our price, the street price, I think we pay somewhere around like $750.
Right, yeah, the 5X is like $400, I think.
The MSRP on the 3X is $799.
It's like twice the price of the 5X.
Yeah, the 5X is $399.
Yeah.
Quick question, JJ. You were saying that the FCC are opening up more 3 gigahertz space for WISPs in the U.S. How much space are they opening up?
Well, I don't know what they're going to do yet.
How much gigahertz? Much bandwidth?
It's looking to be the initial wave of it all. I really hate to say, because you never know what our regulatory bodies will do once the lobbyists get done. But there's 300 megahertz there that they could easily open. With just a couple of swaps of the pins. But when I say opening up for WISP, they're probably LTE-U is wanting that spectrum really, really bad. So I think everybody's lobbying to get it opened up, like whether it be WISPs or big carriers, whoever. I think everybody wants to see it opened up for unlicensed use. With a few strings tied to it.
What's it registered to now? Like what organization's using it?
Some of it is amateur radio spectrum, and some of it is Global Vision, like satellite uplinks, telephones, and Mike may know more about the lower part of it. I'm not real familiar with the.
On the part that's opening up soonest, it would be 3550 to 3650, and that is feds, shipborne radars, airborne radars, and that's been in process for a very long time, but there's going to be some licenses available, but it's not going to be, it's a big departure from what it used to be, like, you know, before it was...
Basically, if you're on the seaboard of North America, you're not going to qualify for any of that spectrum. Because it is, like Mike was saying, it's their high-powered radar that they blast out across the ocean to see if the Russians are coming for us. Over on the
airport. Yeah. And then, like, the whole thing is going to be controlled by a database, or multiple databases, perhaps. And so, like, when your radio powers up and it, you know, phones home, the database will tell it, okay, if you want this size of channel, you are going to be using a center channel of, or I mean, a center frequency of, you know, 3572. And if, so then if you have a license, then you are always guaranteed to have that 10 megahertz. but it will move. It's not like you bought 3550 to 3560. You just bought 10 megahertz, and they will move you around as needed.
That's an interesting concept. Like, yeah, so light licensing?
Yeah, it's, you for certain will always have 10 megahertz if you've auctioned, if you've won 10 megahertz at auction. But you're not always guaranteed which, where it's going to be. And I think that's partially because of the radar. You know, the radar may fire up on this frequency or want to fire up this frequency, so they will move you. And then, the unlicensed guys just have to kind of deal with whatever's left. They are guaranteeing unlicensed space, and the licenses are really small. Like, you used to be able to buy, an entire metropolitan area for, several million dollars for your license. Now it's going to be, if you're in, an urbanized area, it'll be only a dozen blocks is how big your license is. Now, out in the country, the rural area, it'll be several square miles.
How can you say that for just a few blocks, man? Because radio waves, they kind of keep traveling.
Yeah, it's based upon census tracks, I believe, is what the boundaries are going to be. And so if you bleed over, you don't have any extra power being licensed. You just get that space. So your bleed over will still apply. It's just that if someone else is bleeding over to you, they just won't assign anyone else a channel around you if that's, if that would interfere with you.
Gotcha.
And so it's good and bad. There's lots of complaints about it. There's lots of good about it. But I view it as we get a 100 megahertz spectrum that's not being used by anything else right now. So it has to be good.
Yeah, it's definitely exciting, and it looks like, a lot of the European stuff is based off of a lot of the U.S. law when it comes to spectrum allocation, so it'll probably eventually bleed over.
Well, that's what I'm hoping for, because certainly there's a lot of lobbying going on with government at the moment for extra bandwidth for wireless ISPs for the last mile delivery, Andrew, you were going to say something that I think was probably going to be interesting, and then we kind of got cut off, so I'm going to
circle back.
What? I'm going to circle back to Andy.
Do you remember what you were going to say?
I was going to ask something about the Unify access points a long while back, but nothing related to this.
I had some stuff that was interesting about the Unify access points. It was they're adding band steering, which was something I asked for a million years ago. It's,
oh, yeah.
If the AP hears you, beacon out, and it'll ignore you on 2.4 for a second. If it hears you on 5, that way you'll just go ahead and connect on 5 and go. And then I'm assuming that's how they're doing it. That's how a lot of other people do it. They're supposedly having built-in spectral analysis into those units, which I thought was pretty cool, too.
Nice.
That would require a third radio, wouldn't it? Does it run constantly, or?
Well, and it says spectral analysis. Yeah. I didn't get to read, so like the Pro has 2.4 and 5, so that makes me think it's got to have two extra radios in there.
Exactly. They did that on their AC Air Max product, where we have several hundred AC Air Max products in the air right now, and all of those you can go into them and do spectral analysis in real time while it's transmitting. Without having to monkey around, like shut down the link to do a relay. So it's the first time that WISPs are going to be able to do spectral analysis from the perspective of the customer without being there.
And the other nice thing about that was it runs without having to get into the Java app.
Some places I've installed bullets so that I could see, but that's coming from an Omni perspective, and it doesn't take into account the antenna that the actual device you're trying to look at is. Yeah, so that's brilliant. I mean,
The analysis on the AC units it's really nice. And like I said, Jay just said, not having to disrupt the signal, and to also, like I said, not use Java. That's a big win. You can just dial into the GUI and just see what's going on.
Oh, and something else really big while we're kind of jumping all over the place. They picked Air Control 2 back up.
Yeah.
And started moving forward with that again, and that's awesome. Like, because AirCRM to me is garbage. I'm not going into the cloud management of my network ever. Like, I learned my lesson with those other idiots over at Meraki, and I'm never doing that again.
Now, on the AirCRM, after about a week, they did yield, said that they are going to have a local install version of that. So, like, you know, not the proxy device, but like an actual, you install it on your own hardware version of AirCRM.
And that's beautiful. Like, I'm excited about all that. And where my mind jumped to on that is they're going to have real-time spectral analysis. Like, it's all going to be visible on the AC platform from the management suite. So you as the operator can make more intelligent. And I would believe that they're probably trying to move in the direction of having a more auto-everything approach. Kind of, you know, like Mimosa has the auto-everything.
That's intelligent on even your own interference, right?
Right. I think that's kind of the problem right now.
About the awesome spectral analysis, because I think one of my colleagues who kind of looks after Wi-Fi deployments on like large-scale ones, he had tried out the Unify ones, and he was telling me about this spectral analysis, and I was just going, nah, it can't be possible. But what I was just wondering is, JJ or any of the Wi-Fi or wireless legends, how does it compare to, let's say, the offline, you know, the disruptive spectral scan? You know, so the online, let's say, while you work spectral scan, how's that compared to the actual offline spectral scan, let's say, for MikroTik itself?
It should work just as well.
I was going to say the one compared to the MikroTik, the MikroTik doesn't hold a candle.
Has a new AC MikroTik doesn't hold a candle to it.
Oh.
Yeah, that's...
So I see Thomas up there, and the first thing that popped in my head with these amazing spectral scans and then a unified controller is that if, like, the CCQ dropped on a radio, if it could, like, instantly do a spectral scan and just send it to you. So I can see Thomas automating that. So CCQ on a radio link drops down, and it just emails him a GIF of a spectral scan from that radio at the time.
I'm thinking you go one step beyond that, and the controller can just make intelligent decisions knowing what you have in the environment, the positioning of the different radios, the spectral analysis, and all the channels everything's operating on. You can make intelligent decisions on the configuration for the radio in real time, and you can also steer clients to the appropriate radio.
Careful, Alex, with suggestions like that. The black sedan I'll be rolling up beside your door. You'll be taken away.
One other thing I did notice in the Unify is the antenna designs changed significantly. It actually really looks like the antenna design that Ruckus used now, and they're saying that it kind of steers the signal more on us. Like, that's quite interesting.
Well, 802.11 AC is supposed to have standardized beam steering, right?
Right.
Beam
form. That's right.
Yeah.
Right.
That was one of the... So the... It had a couple of cool things. That was standardized. So 802.11 and introduced it, but nobody had it standardized, so it was crap and nobody used it. AC added it as a standard, so everybody should follow it. And then what else did AC? The Moon MIMO, where you can have your AP actually send to multiple customers at a single time, or multiple clients simultaneously. It doesn't help you on the upload from the clients, but you can actually send out to multiple, and that's cool. I guess in a WISP environment, that'll be really interesting. Your client actually has to support it, and if you're using WISP equipment, you know, fixed-base wireless is going to do it, maybe not necessarily in the Wi-Fi market. I know Thomas, who was here just a minute ago, made the comment the other day that 802.11 is AC over-promises and under-delivers, I think is how he said it.
Yeah.
And I saw, who was it, ASUS put out, it looked like a giant spider with eight antennas on there, which the standard supposedly supports up to eight antennas, and there they go.
It's a tire spike.
Right? But, like, to get the, I think, what is it, to get the over a gig speed that they say that you can actually attain, you have to have eight antennas, and then you have to have, like, 160 megahertz channels or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's just...
Take out the whole 5-gig spectrum.
Yeah, it's not feasible. Maybe if your whole house is covered in tinfoil, you could probably get that on the inside, but it just doesn't make any sense.
market opportunity for people to make Tesla standard homes, you know?
You just start building your homes underground. Everybody's in bunkers. It'll be perfect. So yeah, don't get me started on the AC stuff. It looks great. But you know, I mean, there's optimizations.
Even if it under-delivers, it still performs better than the other standards.
Yeah. I mean,
well, exactly.
They do frame aggregation and stuff like that, so they'll pack multiple frames in and wrap it. I mean, they've been doing that since 802.11n, though.
Yeah.
So you can pack
the EDMA frame timings, I forget exactly what they call it. They're exposing that information in the AirFiber, the new beta of the AirFiber software. And
lost JJ there. I'm not sure where he was going with that.
And as they're doing that, they have really broken the ability to run latency-sensitive applications. So I hope they can find a happy medium between huge throughput and consistent latency.
JJ, can you repeat that? Because you dropped off for about 30 seconds there.
Right in the middle.
Sorry, I was basically saying that they've been working on TDMA frame sizes on the Air Max AC stuff. And with that being said, they are really messing up the latency of latency-sensitive applications in trade for higher throughput. So I'm hoping that we can strike a balance as an industry on where those frame sizes need to be or what those timings need to be.
Yeah, so, that's one thing that people have noted in the backhauls from, I can't say the name of the damn company now, on the B5s and the B5Cs, that you choose 2 milliseconds, 4 milliseconds, or 6 milliseconds latency. And 6 has the most throughput, 2 has the least. Not that it's, you know, goes to a pittance or anything, but, you know, it tells you, hey, you want faster latency, but it's all end-user selectable. It's not, they just tell you what you're going to get. You can choose.
That's great. And I think they're about to do that on the air fibers. I see them cloning some features and whatnot on different platforms. But I wanted to say that it was a pleasure being here with you guys this evening, and I'm going to have to graciously bow out and go finish up. The WISP work is never done.
Thanks, JJ. All right.
See you later, man.
Thank you, guys.
Was there anything of interest anybody wanted to talk about? Anything else off the list? I know we've
you know, I tried the... probably wouldn't take too much time, but I actually downloaded and tried out. I've been on the beta for a little bit, but the MikroTik app for Android. And it's actually, you know, pretty good. The decent feature set. The app functions as you'd expect. It seems to be pretty performant. You guys play around with that at all?
It somewhat. I haven't had a lot of time to put through its paces, but I like the concept, and in that thread, they seem to be really responding. You know, there's always new updates and people giving feedback and them not just telling you that you're dumb. You know, they're actually fixing it.
What's the end game for that app? I'm just curious. I mean, where are they? What's it?
Everybody's making
it for.
That's a unique selling point.
You know, if you're using it up on. I was just going to say a couple things. One, somebody like Ramosa, they have the tool where you can connect to the radio with your app and do your aiming from the roof, right?
Yeah.
So I could see you doing the same thing with the MikroTik. If you have dual radios, you could connect to one and do your aiming with the mobile app. Or the other application would be the home use. If you have the HAP, for example, and you're trying to reach the consumer audience, you get your new access point and you want to configure it, you could connect with your mobile device without having a Windows Winbox install. Or, you know, I guess most devices you could hit the browser, but still.
I was thinking it was when you're on the John and someone says there's a problem, you can improve your response time.
Sure.
That's where I was kidding. thinking about it. Come on.
I was impressed they had Discovery built in, and also live graphing of like interface traffic and whatnot.
That's kind
of
cool.
That was awesome. And like, you know, I can see it as, you know, as all society moves more towards, you know, mobile devices and less towards, you know, Windows apps. You know, all your installers have phones. They don't, you know, and phones are, you know, they have to have a phone. So if you cannot buy them a Windows laptop to do the install, then, you know, it's a lot nicer.
OpenBSD have added pseudo-wire support. So they have a layer 2 tunneling interface for MPLS in 5.8. So it'll be released in November.
Right, so...
I can see you all rushing out to download it and try it.
I have some OpenBSD boxes. I've got two virtual, two physical.
Rock on.
Thrifty's got an army of them, I'm sure.
One other thing, seemed to be getting closer to close here. I wanted to mention, if you have bought a Unified Vision, whatever C is, micro camera, reach out to Ubiquiti. They're if you haven't noticed already, their 2.4 Wi-Fi is junk. And they didn't call it a recall, but they said, message this guy if you have one, and they'll take care of it. Okay. Found a hardware bug, and they'll be sending out new ones.
That's cool. All right, so let's bring it to a close. Andrew Thrift, it was awesome having you all the way from the other side of the world, and... I know you're always working on some new stuff, so is there anything cool and interesting that you're looking forward to?
Well, Rudder OSV7, of course. the cloud-hosted router from Microtik sounds really, really promising. I don't know if you guys have talked about that in the previous podcast, but...
It's
for people who don't know... For people who don't know what that is, it's Microtik looked to be moving their x86 version into... the future. It's going to have 64-bit support, which will make Tom very happy. Also changing their licensing scheme so that it's a pay-per-month kind of thing. The pricing they've indicated currently seems ridiculously low. It's like $2 US a month or something. And it looks like they're adding fast path support into x86, so Intel DPDK or something similar to that. Yep, so this is going to be a bit of a killer. A lot of people that are running the Cisco, where it is, 1000V or the Vieta VMs for DPDK support will now be able to look at this. And
it's the or Juniper's VMX or Alcatel's whatever it was.
XLV.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is going to be a really good product for Microtik. I think they should have done this years ago, but hey... Yeah, I think it's moving
in the right direction. All right, Mike. So I know you've been busy. You were just at a NANOG meeting? It was at an Aaron meeting.
Tuesday, actually Wilson went as well. I didn't know he was going until I saw that he was on the way there. NANOG and Aaron. Aaron is... our people where you got IPs from, kind of like APNIC or RIPE. NANOG is North American Network Operators Group. They always have like two big shows a year, but then they started doing these on the roads where they tour and do small shows. Like this was just one day at just some like random hotel in the suburbs of Chicago, and they had, you know, Aaron staff, NANOG staff. You know, it wasn't nearly as big as a full-fledged show, but, you know, there's still networking to be done and presentations. I passed around that pretty awesome optics presentation that everyone that's read it seems to think it's the greatest thing.
Oh, yeah. I'll definitely link it. It was really good.
But then I will also be going to the full-blown Aaron and Nanog next month. Looks like October 4th through the 10th. I'll be in Montreal, Canada, courtesy of Aaron.
Nobody cares, Mike.
Aaron paid my airfare, hotels, and Nanog fees, and gave me a $400 stipend for the week.
Did they require you to mention them?
No, it's just you just apply. Aaron and Nanog both have fellowship programs where they're trying to encourage, you know, new people to be involved with the communities. I think there's five total programs between Aaron and Nanog that to, you know, they'll pay the way for you to go to their shows.
Right. Send me a link, Mike. I'm going to sign up.
Yeah.
Send me a...
Don't send Tom a link.
Please.
And so then I will be there for a week, and I saw Alex was asking about it. I will also be at Wispapalooza in Las Vegas the week after Aaron Nanog. So I'll be in Canada for a week. I fly back on Saturday. Sunday I leave to go to Vegas for the next week.
Nobody cares, Mike.
Well, Alex cares. He might go if I, you know, if I will go. So I'll be there.
All right. So I'm almost afraid to ask it, but Tom, what do you have coming up that you're interested in?
I kind of finished up a contract there in a bank there about 2 days ago, so it's kind of tidied up my network. Gotcha. That I've been kind of neglected, so I'm kind of all excited.
So you've laundered the money and you're laying low right now.
Basically, the way my colleagues say is I was making money out in the field and now I'm spending a fortune and not making money. So it's like a reverse thrust on the whole money-making thing. So they're quite upset with me in the office at the moment. I've been scouring various websites for different things going, I need this part, I need this part, I need this router, I need this server. And yeah, so if you see any liquidation of an ISP in Ireland, it's because but yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it. Like, there's a few things I wanted to try out. Believe it or not, we were looking at some idea stuff, and I think I'm going to have to rob your idea, Greg, of Security Onion. So I'm going to start downloading that right now. And so thanks for that. It's always great to, and I'd like to thank the lads, because it's always great to hear stuff that you're doing and ideas.
I love memorizing what you guys say and then just regurgitating it to strangers. You know, they think you're just the most clever guy. It's brilliant.
Well, it worked for me when I first saw your BGP tutorial, Craig. And also, Andy, Jesus, I remember doing my first MPLS training. I was like, yeah, I really need to brush up with this stuff. And suddenly I saw some stuff from Andrew Tripp. So I ripped you off and I sold. Basically, it was like, I couldn't do a New Zealand accent, but basically it was you who were talking to the class that day. But I learned an awful lot, so sorry. I haven't sent you any money, so I suppose I should do that. But sorry for that.
I just repeat your jokes and pass them off as my own.
Ah, boom, fist bump. That's all.
So is that why he has to send you money? Because they're that bad?
Might be.
Could be. All right, Alex, up in Portland now, no longer Seattle. What's new? What's interesting? What are you looking forward to?
I've actually been working a lot lately. I've done this a few times in the past, but logging a tremendous amount of data into Elasticsearch and exposing that with Kibana front end. So that's what I've been spending time on lately.
All right. I don't know anything about that stuff.
Just a cool way to get all of your devices' logging data in a central location and have a nice front end to view it and massage information out of it.
That's cool. What kind of devices are you able
to... So what's it called? Elasticsearch, and what's the other thing?
Elasticsearch is the back-end storage. The front end is Kibana. So you can send syslog. You can send from any network or servers all the logging data into one location. And then you can look at, like, if there's an event in your network or with your servers, you can see what's going on from a central location. So maybe see how things correlate.
Is it something like a syslog NG server?
It's much better than that, but similar, yeah.
Okay.
Is it commercial or free?
Free.
Free is good.
Downloading that after security.
just to confuse you guys more, we use something very similar called Greylog 2, which is stick search and does a similar thing. I haven't used the other one, but they both, well, Greylog works really, really well. We use it like a core piece of our monitoring system now.
Is it just more efficient than SysLogNG? Is that what makes it better?
It's more easily searchable, and you can like define streams, so you can like kind of create a regular expression, not even a regular expression, something that looks like a regular expression, though, for a particular event, and it will only show you that type of event. So you filter out a lot of noise and that sort of thing. It's just a much better way of searching your logs.
Not only searching, but it also gives you the ability to stream while you're logging in real time through the browser. More importantly, it gives you visualization in like graph format, for example. So it's a lot easier to see different events that occur visually in a graph than just looking at text when you're searching through logs.
What's the name of the front end again?
Kibana. K-I-B-A-N-A.
Oh, so not like a Kibana boy.
Yeah, Kibana.
There you go. So I'm assuming you can also do like alerts in those things?
Yeah, absolutely.
So as stuff comes through, it'll catch a phrase and email you?
Sure. Or you can say, not traditionally with syslog, you can have filters around events. This allows you to bucketize those. So maybe if you get one event in your log that matches your search, you don't want to get an email notification. But if there's a certain amount happening in per an interval, like say 50 per second or something, then email. You don't get as much noise, or maybe you don't get an email for every one of those in the 50, every 50 events in that 1 second.
Wow. So, pretty hot. That's cool.
Yeah.
All right. That's Thomas, the master of NetXMS and everything about everything, apparently, that I've ever asked. what's new? And so as you guys know, Thomas works for RF Elements, and so he loves to hint and tease at things and then never follow through. So he's like every girlfriend you've ever had. but is there anything interesting you're working on that you can actually talk about?
There's lots of interesting things that I can't talk about and some that I can. But since I was really late joining you, then maybe next time. But basically what I've been doing for the better part of the last year is being on a holy crusade of automizing everything or automating everything and monitoring absolutely everything. And I'm just about finished and just about, my inner control freak is just about happy with the result now. So pretty much my objective from the start was, as I said, automate everything, monitor everything, and streamline workflows into a single tool. So we basically do everything from provisioning to backups, through monitoring, through graphing, through alerting, and everything else in a single tool. And I could talk about this for hours. It's making me I'm completely crazy about this and how happy I am with the result. But maybe next time.
Right.
But
I think that's probably a presentation unto itself. You go crazy. But at the core of it is NetXMS, right?
Yes, everything is based around NetXMS, which is the central tool where we basically completely organized all of our workflows in. And as I said, I'm just really happy with the result, because basically with a single click I can back up one router or 1,000 routers. And with a single click, I can provision, anything from one router to 1,000 routers, and it just, I could talk about it for hours, really. So maybe next time.
And you do one for YouTube series.
Yes, I actually have a YouTube tutorial series on NetXMS, which is only the basics series now, which is already about, I think, 3 hours or something like that. But actually, a couple cool things, like Andrew mentioned with CHR, the cloud-hosted router, one really cool project that I've done lately is I've made a headless simulation server of GNS, So I have a remote GNS3 server, which is just a virtual machine in our cluster. And, you know, I used to run all of my simulations in GNS on my local machines, and every time I would hop from my laptop to all of my PCs and etc., it would just be a pain. And, you know, on the little laptop, it took me a long time to spin up any simulation, any bigger topology. So I've migrated pretty much all of that into a headless simulation server, and the GNS3 on my local machine is now just a client, and it works really well. I'm really happy with the result there as well. And from my tests, basically, I can spin up 100 MikroTik CHR routers in 5 minutes, which is the startup time, which is actually really tiny if you've ever dealt with bigger GNS topologies. And of course, once it's already spun up, it just works. But actually, if I wanted to simulate 100 MikroTik routers on my local laptop, that would be just, I would probably wait for half an hour for all of them to come up. So yeah, that was one of the interesting projects which I was doing lately. And so basically what we do is our whole team now actually uses the server, and we can share topologies easily, and it's fun stuff like that.
Yeah, you know, just stuff everybody does all the time. No big deal. But I wanted to point out those NetXMS videos that you put out. You didn't, I mean, they look, they're brilliant, and I've actually gone through the first handful of them. You didn't get paid to do that, right?
No, that was just something.
You just did
something.
It to do it and put it out there. It's brilliant. I would encourage anybody to take a look at it.
The biggest problem with NetXMS, it's like a wonderful, wonderful piece of software that can do so many things, but the barrier of entry to it is extremely high, because it's really complex. Like what you guys mentioned with logs and log commenting and everything else, we actually do that in NetXMS. So all of our servers, all of our routers, everything that we have actually drops logs into NetXMS, and then we have complex rules that match certain logs based on as well regular expressions and stuff like that. And then we have certain events being fired with different severities, and there is event processing with different thresholds and severities and everything else on those logs. And like, that's just one of like 50 features of NetXMS, which is in itself it requires a lot of knowledge and a lot of know-how in syslog and in networking, in of course NetXMS and regular expressions and everything else. So like, NetXMS is a wonderful, wonderful software, but the barrier of entry is really high. So I decided to, you know, help out and just create something that would ease the barrier of entry, and it turned out to be a 3-hour introduction series.
It's cool. I spent at least 12 hours watching it, just going over it and just doing it, and of course bothering Thomas for another 12 hours.
Yeah, and I know Miller's been using it a lot, and he's been having some really good success with it too. So I'm encouraged, and I think I'm going to be probably trying to migrate to it probably later in the year, because it does simple stuff like port up and port down. I expect this port to be up. If it goes down, let me know.
Oh, yeah.
Nice simple little things like that. But that's cool. That's cool. So let me see. What have I been doing? I've been putting out a whole lot of fires lately. I've been working heavily on this forward-looking system, right? So anybody who's got multiple peers that's dealing with the internet, you know that it's a wild animal, you know, the internet is. There's no way to control it. As soon as it leaves your door, there's not a lot you can do. So I've been working with a system where it's pretty cool. It basically dumps NetFlow, collects that, looks at your top 1,000 talkers, and then starts probing out all of your ISPs individually to those top 1,000 talkers. And it can actually manipulate and massage your traffic and reroute using IBGP from this service. It'll shift traffic over left and right, and then it can also, anybody who's done networking for a while on the internet, sometimes your upstream will black hole your traffic for whatever reason. You know, your direct peer with them stays up, full route table, everything's great, your infrastructure's 100% rock solid, it works just like it's supposed to, but they screw up upstream somewhere and it affects you negatively, right? So this system can actually probe and look out, find those things, and then reroute around. Kind of puts a little bit of that control back in your pocket, because that's one thing I hate, is feeling out of control, right? I control this piece and this piece, but this middle is somebody else's responsibility, and I have no say in it, right? And if I'm guaranteeing somebody it's going to be up, I want to be able to do that with as much certainty as I can. You know, to me, just saying I'm sorry or I'll pay you back isn't enough, right? And so this is kind of, and I'm sure I'll do a little bit more on it as soon as we get it full into production, working, and I mean, I'm fired up about this stuff. It's pretty awesome. Obviously, it's good stuff because it came out of Poland, right? It wasn't made here in the States, so you know it's good. But that's kind of what I'm looking forward to in the future, as well as in a couple of weeks, I'm flying to California to do a training thing I've been kind of building up to. And I'll probably talk about it once it's done. But I'm not there yet. So,
Greg, just one quick question. What's the name of the software that you're using to do all that magic gizmetry?
I'll tell you in a minute. Okay. I gotta keep some of that stuff in your pocket for later. I gotta work out my my referral deal with them first, and then I'll tell you what it is. No. Let's see. So let's put a bow on this thing, man. We've gone almost 2 hours, like we always do. It always ends up going 2 hours. It doesn't matter how often. Thanks everybody for coming out. Thanks to all the people who watch and Hound, especially Mike for not putting out more content. So we'll upload this one, and then probably about the same time I'll upload the other one that they put up already.
Like 2 weeks ago we've recorded another show that as of yet has not been posted.
Stop being sassy, Mike. All right, guys. Well, let's sign off.
Thanks, guys.